Hi, and welcome again to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, with the stories behind the greatest rock and roll albums in history. Today we go in the studio with one of America's hardest working, funkiest, juke joint jumping bands.
Shows was like a house party. You know, you come and get crazy, we're gonna get twice as crazy. You get three times as crazy, we're gonna get four times as crazy. You get five times as crazy, we're gonna get 10 times as crazy. We're gonna have a house party, we're gonna tear this building down. We're gonna rock and roll, we're gonna get a two. Can you hear me on the left side? And people wouldn't say yes, I'd walk on the left side, jump into the crowd. If they couldn't get crazy, I'd make them get crazy. And I'd walk over to the right side and say, can you hear me? Can you get crazy? I'd jump into the right side of the crowd. And then I'd get up and would say, man, it ain't nothing. We're gonna have nothing tonight but a house party, and Jay would just kick off.
I must have got lost. I must have got lost. Give away the day in your mind.
This is Wolf of Goofy Mama 2 for Pete Wolf telling you if it's in you, it's got to come out, because that's what rock and roll is all about, and you're listening to In the Studio with Bloodshot and Nightmares and Other Tales from the Vinyl Jungle.
Ow yourself. Let the record show that the Jay Giles Band made their mark in rock and roll history the old-fashioned way, by working hard and playing even harder, combining superb musicianship with live performances that were notorious for their ability to leave entire audiences gasping for breath. Word spread quickly about the Jay Giles Band in the early 70s. Formed in Boston in 1967, the Jay Giles Band consisted of guitarist Jerome Jay Giles, bass player Daniel D.K. Klein, Stephen Joe Blatt on drums, Magic Dick Salwitz on harmonica, keyboard player Seth Justman, and one of the most colorful frontmen in the business, Peter Wolf. Ironically, Wolf never intended to be a singer. Armed with a grant from the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, Peter had been diligently studying painting. But then, one fateful night while partying with his fellow art students, Wolf was asked to sing a tune with the band. As a lifelong fan of rock and roll and the blues, that was all it took. Peter quickly traded in his paintbrush for a microphone and never looked back. As to how he eventually hooked up with the rest of the Jay Giles Band, I'll let Peter Wolf tell the story.
I had this band called... Sometimes we call the Hallucinations, sometimes we call the Hallucinations. And we traveled a lot with Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, and we played a lot of R&B and blues things and just a lot of rock and roll. And it was primarily just a bunch of us who dropped out of art school. And a couple of guys wanted to go off and paint and, you know, go on spiritual soul searching missions. I sort of got left stranded in Boston, and I wanted to keep playing. So I was at this little coffee house, and there was these three guys. It was Jay and DK and Magic Dick on harmonica, and they were playing in this club. And, man, they were really good. So they had known me from seeing the band I was with, and so afterwards we got to rapping, and they said, well, you know, they're looking for a singer maybe or a drummer. And I said, well, why don't we get together tomorrow and let's see what we can do. And that was how I put together the Giles Band.
Do you want to dance? Shuffle.
Their top 10 album, Bloodshot. That's the Jay Giles Band with the Southside Shuffle. As soon as Peter Wolf, Jay Giles, Magic Dick, and DK got together to play, they realized immediately that they had two very important things in common. Once again, here's Peter Wolf.
Well, we all had a dislike for the commercial pop radio at the time, and we all really loved, you know, a lot of great blues and rhythm and blues and early rock and roll things like, you know, Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Buddy Holly. But I mean, the music of Muddy Waters and Junior Wells and James Cotton and John Lee Hooker and Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James. And, oh boy, the list can go on and on and on. I think, you know, we all were great lovers of, you know, the, you know, black American rhythm and blues. And I think the thing that really struck us about it and what struck us about early rock and roll was that it was so believable. You know, if you heard somebody, you know, talking about, you know, I'm going to get you, or, you know, look out, man, you know, I'm going to cut you, or, you know, you believe the voices, you believe the singers, you know.
The quartet soon added a drummer and a keyboard player, which meant the only thing left to do was find a name. As Peter Wolf told me, they could have called themselves Yo Mama for all he cared, but Jay's manager insisted they call it the Jay Giles Band, and that was okay with just about everyone. Except Jerome. According to Peter Wolf, Giles would have been much more comfortable just playing his guitar in the background.
I think he would have not liked, I think as years went by, he wished it, you know, it never happened, because, I mean, Jay really liked to just be anonymous and sort of, he really didn't enjoy a lot of the notoriety. I mean, he really was like a guy that loved playing his guitar. He would get to the gigs the earliest. I mean, if we were going to go on, say, like at, you know, 9 o'clock or something, Jay would get there at 6, and he'd just sit there in the dressing room with his guitar and just, you know, really loosen up. And that's, I think, how he and Dwayne Allman became good friends. We used to play, the Allman Brothers and Giles Band used to play so much together that Dwayne and Jay used to find themselves, you know, just hanging out, you know, playing guitars, and they became real friendly and supportive of each other. But Jay was sort of really very sweet, mild guy, and I think if he had to do it over again, he probably wished the band was called Your Mama or something.
Like most young groups, the Jay Giles Band didn't have much money in those early days, and that made for some very interesting recording techniques when it came time to do those first demo tapes.
Jay Giles and Magic Dick and DK on bass, they all lived together in this little apartment. Brownstone apartment was on the first floor, and we would all get together, and in the living room, the front room, is where we rarely would rehearse. And we rehearsed by day, and at night we'd go out to these lounges and play. And so all of the tunes, like Looking for Love and things like Cruising for Love, they were all put together and at Jay's and Dick's and DK's apartment. And the apartment had this little bathroom. And so on our first demo tapes and stuff, I'd go into the bathroom and sing. It's had this great echo, and we used to call them our bathroom tapes.
Keep it close to me, baby, all the time.
is one of my favorites from the Jay Giles Band, the 1973 album Bloodshot. That's called Back to Get You. When we come back to get you, we'll find out why radio stations refuse to play a big single by the Jay Giles Band. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for Bloodshot. Welcome back to In the Studio, this week focusing on two albums from the Jay Giles Band, Bloodshot and Nightmares. By the time their third studio album was released, Bloodshot, in 1973, the Jay Giles Band was becoming well-known as an album group. Then, Give It to Me was released from Bloodshot, and it looked like the Giles Band finally might have their first big hit single. But as Peter Wolf remembers, unforeseen circumstances changed all that very quickly.
Well, that was interesting. It was a time when the FCC, people started writing letters about that there was too much pornography coming out in rock and roll, and not unlike what's going on today. And the FCC decided they're going to investigate, and McCartney had this song out called My Love, and My Love Does It, you know, My Love Does It Fine, My Love Does It Right, whatever. And we had Give It to Me, and we weren't quite in the same league as McCartney, obviously. And a lot of stations, it was sort of on its way to becoming a top 10 hit. But then a lot of program directors were threatened by, you know, it being a little bit risque. And so within a week, everybody stopped playing it. So it was sort of banned. It was, they thought it was too suggestive, sexually suggestive for the teenage mind. And there was a lot of heat coming down. And for some reason, there was an article in Billboard and a couple of the trade papers, and Give It to Me was cited as an example of a promiscuous kind of song that shouldn't be on the airwaves because it was too sexually exploitive. And it's pretty common. You know, I think we were just talking about, you know, hey, give me that backbeat, maybe.
You got to give it to me.
Hard to believe that song was too risque for Top 40 Radio in 1973. That's the single version of Give It to Me, originally from Bloodshot. Even though that tune never had a chance to be a hit, Bloodshot still made it to number 10 on the album charts and became the first gold record for the J. Geils Band. The success of the album could be attributed to a couple of things: airplay at FM rock radio stations and the J. Geils Band's incredible live shows. You see, the J. Geils Band had learned early on how to please a crowd by playing to audiences that had only one thing in mind.
Well, to be honest, I mean, we really play what we call lounges. And lounges back then were sort of, you know, maybe in the South they call them juke joints or honky-tonks. They were drinking places, and people came to sort of drink, and our jobs are just to make noise and keep people dancing. And most of the places were used to guys who were playing the top 40 hits, and we didn't do it. Not because we didn't want it, because we just never really listened to those songs. I mean, we didn't know what was like on the top 10. I mean, we really had no idea. I mean, every now and then on a gig, we'd be, you know, listening to the radio or something. But, you know, we just had no desire to, you know, learn how to play a Herman's Hermits tune or, you know, and I'm not putting it down. It just was not what interested us, you know, and they were kind of rough places. I mean, we got to meet a lot of interesting, crazy kind of characters, and a lot of the Giles songs like Juke Joint Jimmy and, you know, Floyd's Hotel and Cruising for Love and, you know, a lot of the Vespits and a lot of the street jargon and a lot of the sensibility came out of working many years in those kind of places.
Right from the start, the J. Geils Band seemed destined to be a favorite among the alternative FM radio crowd of the early 70s. In fact, it was this alternative music that inadvertently led to their first record deal. Here's Peter Wolf.
There were certain clubs started forming that also catered to this new music. And fortunately, the Geils Band was able to play in these clubs. And I remember we played when Jeff Beck first came to the States, or when Fleetwood Mac, or when Traffic, or The Who. And we're talking about clubs of maybe only a couple hundred people. And we were sort of like the house band at one of these clubs, and it was called the Boston Tea Party here in Boston. And one night, there was a fellow by the name of Mario Medias, called him the Big M, and he was working for Atlantic Records. And he was in the back room, and he heard the Geils Band playing, and he thought it was like a, you know, blues band from Chicago. He thought it was like maybe, you know, a Muddy Waters spinoff or something. And he was so surprised to see these young white guys out there jumping around playing. He called up Jerry Wexler from Atlantic Records. And Jerry Wexler was very friendly with a fellow by the name of John Landau, who now is the manager of Bruce Springsteen. And he asked John, he said, "John, you know about this guy, J. Geils Band?" And John said, "Yeah, man, Pete Wolf's a real good friend of mine. You know, I know him." He said, "Well, why don't you come on down?" And John and I drove down to New York. We met with Jerry Wexler the next week, and we were signed with Atlantic Records. We had no lawyer, no nothing, just me and John and a piece of paper, and that's how it sort of went down.
For most bands, getting that first record deal means a chance at the big time. But as Peter Wolf tells it, when the J. Geils Band signed their first contract, they were only interested in one thing.
We weren't concerned about royalties, weren't concerned about how long the deal was, wasn't concerned, we didn't even care about the money. There was one thing that I know I was concerned about, and that was they wanted to put us on ATCO, which was a subsidiary of Atlantic. And I said, "No, man." I said to John, "I want to be on Atlantic. You know, that's where Larry Charles was on, and, you know." And so I remember John saying, "You know, Jerry, there's one thing about this contract that we, you know, bothers us." And he said, "What's that, John?" He said, "Well, I think, you know, Peter and the guys want to be on Atlantic." And Jerry looked at the lawyer, Atlantic's lawyer, and said, "Well, I don't know. We're thinking of ATCO, and do you think we can change it?" You know, and they went through some song and dance, and finally, "Well, we'll see what we can do." And, you know, we ended up on Atlantic Records.
When the J. Geils Band recorded their first album in 1970, they wound up doing many of the cover tunes that had been a part of their live set for years. But this reliance on outside material had tapered down by the time they recorded Bloodshot. By then, Peter Wolf and Seth Justman were co-writing most of the tunes. They did still find room on the album, however, to do two covers, including Ain't Nothing But a House Party, which had always been one of Wolf's favorites, by a Philadelphia band called The Showstoppers. But after it appeared on Bloodshot, it soon became a trademark J. Geils track.
it was just one of them records that, you know, again, had sort of the theme of what the Gals Band was about. It ain't nothing but a house party. And that's what we used to call, you know, our shows was like a house party. You know, you come and get crazy, we're going to get twice as crazy. You get three times as crazy, we're going to get four times as crazy. You get five times as crazy, we're going to get 10 times as crazy. We're going to have a house party. We're going to tear this building down. We're going to rock and roll. We're going to get a two. Can you hear me on the left side? And people wouldn't say yes. I'd walk on the left side. I'd jump into the crowd. If they couldn't get crazy, I'd make them get crazy. And I'd walk over to the right side and say, can you hear me? Can you get crazy? I'd jump into the right side of the crowd. And then I'd get up and would say, man, it ain't nothing. We're gonna have nothing tonight but a house party, and Jay would just kick off, and boy.
We'll be right back.
Bloodshot. That's Ain't Nothing But a House Party. Up next, we'll hear the story behind the Jay Giles Band's first big hit single. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for Bloodshot and Nightmares.
Welcome back to the studio. I'm Pete Wolf, and I'm here with Red Beard, and we're taking it to it and getting right through. If it's in you, it's got to come out, because that's what rock and roll is all about.
Well said, Pete. Following the top 10 success of 1973's album Bloodshot, the Jay Giles Band came back the next year with Nightmares and Other Tales from the Vinyl Jungle. It became their second top 30 album. And even more importantly, Nightmares produced their first hit single, Musta Got Lost. Peaking at number 12 in 1974, Musta Got Lost was written about Peter Wolf's high school sweetheart and longtime companion. Peter tells the story.
I was on a plane, and I had written most of the lyrics on an envelope, and had somewhat of the melody. I remember getting together with Seth, and he really liked it, and he, you know, sort of fooled around with the arrangement a bit and added some accordings to it, and it was one of those songs that sort of really fell into place pretty quickly, and it's just that must have got lost somewhere down the line, and it was, I remember feeling like out in the road, and it was just sort of, I don't know, one night too many, and I just was flying alone somewhere to this person that, this lady friend of mine, and I was just thinking, man, somewhere, it seems like I got lost, you know, and I just felt that, you know, what had happened? I mean, where did I feel that somehow I sort of took the wrong path?
Never thought about tomorrow. Like a long time to come. How could I be so blind, baby, not to see you were the one? I let you slip on from me, honey. I let you walk on.
Song. Must have got lost somewhere down the line with the Jay Giles Band from the album Nightmares. Now, there's sadly no happy ending to that love song, even though he spent many years with her. Peter Wolf never married the woman he wrote that song about. I'm sorry to tell you that she was tragically killed some years later. Peter did, however, get married in the mid-70s to none other than award-winning actress Faye Dunaway. Now, as you may remember, the media at the time tried to blow their marriage way out of proportion. But Mr. and Mrs. Wolf would have none of that.
it was one of those things where being married to someone that was also in the public eye and the, you know, a performer and stuff, it was sort of, we just started from day one not to make it one of those kind of public kind of marriages that were going to, you know, do all this sort of public PR and all that Barbara Walters stuff. And plus, I married a person because I loved her, and she was a real big fan of music and of rock and roll. And she would always come to shows and just sort of hang out and hang in with the crew and sit around and drive all night with us. So it was pretty easy. I mean, it was not really, there was no complications. The difficulties, you know, came when the band would be touring night after night, and she'd be working in some other part of the country or other part of the world and trying to keep it all together. I think ultimately that took its toll. And, you know, plus I was very young, and it was, you know, we both were and still are good friends. But I don't think we let it, we're just two people trying to get by.
As Peter and I talked about Bloodshot and Nightmares, he told me that in the early years of the J. Geils Band, they felt much more at home on stage than in the studio. And with that in mind, it probably came as no surprise that when I asked Wolf about their first big break, Peter didn't tell me about their record deal or the J. Geils Band's first hit single. Instead, Peter remembers playing live at a piece of rock and roll history called the Fillmore East.
I think the big thing was when we finally got into... there was an article in Rolling Stone, and finally played the Fillmore. And word got out that we sort of tore it up down at the Fillmore. And then Bill Graham loved us so much, he booked us back and then sent us right out to the Fillmore West. And word got out. You know, there was a word of mouth in rock and roll in those years that was pretty exciting, because you could hear about a band. Yeah, man, they talk about this band out of Philly that's really hot. You know, and you hear about them. Man, they're going to be in town in about a month. And you made sure you were there, you know. And when things had that word-of-mouth buzz, there was some credence behind it. And, you know, you would hear about it, and it was, you know, the only magazine of any national sense was Rolling Stone, and that was pretty much like a little paper. It wasn't really like it was today. And, you know, this was pre-MTV and pre-national news, and there was not very much rock and roll on television at all. So a lot of it had to do with word of mouth and the radio stations. And there was still, you were still able to get regional bands. And if you went to, say, like Alabama, you would hear much different rock and roll if you were in Oklahoma or if you were in California or New York.
Peter Wolf went on to tell me that even though Bloodshot and Nightmares helped to put the J. Geils Band on the rock and roll map, it was definitely their live performances that really told the story.
I really don't think if I hadn't seen the band live, I don't know if I would understand or even maybe enjoy the records. I think to really understand Giles' records, you've had to see the show, because sometimes the studio albums, we would get in and try to be like a real band and try to keep the tempos down and make it sound kind of right. But when we got on stage, we let all hell break loose. And I think a lot of what the albums were was sort of, a lot of the songs really didn't come to life until we were on stage kicking.
What Bloodshot and Nightmares did for the J. Geils Band more than anything else, really, was to let the rest of the country in on what the blue-collar towns of the Northeast and the Upper Midwest already knew. The J. Geils Band was for real. I wondered why the J. Geils Band caught on in such a big way in places like Detroit and Cleveland. And Peter Wolf was pretty sure he knew the answer.
I think they were industrial towns, especially like in Detroit, where most of the audience's families worked in the car factories. And most of the people in Detroit had that to look forward to. There was, you know, not much else or get out. And so when they were really come the weekend and they were coming sort of to like release all the anxieties, you know, and all the pressures, they would use rock and roll as that kind of release. And so they took their rock and roll serious. And I guess we were so serious about the rock and roll, and we were so intent about our performances, where we, you know, really insisted that each performance be as if it was going to be our last. I think that there was a sort of exchange that happened where those audiences really realized that we weren't kidding. I mean, we really might not have been the greatest of players, or I might not have been the greatest of singers, but we really put 110% into every performance.
Thank you.
paying tribute to the city that had always been one of their biggest strongholds. That's the Jay Giles Band with Detroit Breakdown, the Motor City Shakedown. We'll be right back in the studio after this. Yeah, 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 yeah.